Well, thank you all for being here. This is an important discussion. We talk a lot about theory, and our hearts are inspired and warmed by the beauty of the gospel at conferences like this. But then we go back to our church settings, our different church contexts, and we seek to apply a lot of this truth in the way we do church, in some of the practical nitty-gritty aspects of church ministry. And so I appreciate Mark Dever, Michael Kelly, and Matt Chandler being available for this panel discussion. Each of us represent different models and methodologies of how we do discipleship in smaller groups, how we do education of adults in smaller groups. We'll also talk as well about some education for kids and some things. So there's some different perspectives represented here, and I think the benefit of a panel like this is for us to all with the same heart, we want to see people discipled. We believe that there's value in smaller groups as we come together in discipleship and education. We want to talk about the purpose of smaller groups, of Sunday school classes, of community groups, the different models and methods that are out there. And each one of us, I think we would all admit that there are strengths and weaknesses to any of our models. But you're going to hear us today as we present sort of the way our actual churches do things. We're going to kind of push for our methodology or our model because that's what we see has more strengths than weaknesses. But I don't want you to come away thinking that we're not united by the same heart or that we don't recognize that our own models also have their flaws. Different churches do things in different ways in different contexts, and the Lord uses all sorts of methods and models. But it's good for us to have this conversation, and hopefully it will be a conversation where iron is sharpening iron, and hopefully we're praying that you will be edified as you think through these issues as well. So Mark Dever does we're going to be talking about sort of the Sunday school hour. What does it look like when you can cluster smaller groups around the worship services for the express purpose of education, primarily? And we'll also talk about the small group ministry that your church has. I'll say Matt Chandler next is more the community groups, home groups. The actual groups are meeting and discussing the sermons. It's aligned with Matt Chandler's preaching ministry, something similar to what's called the sticky church model. And then you've got Michael Kelly. He's here because he's actually my sister's Sunday school teacher. Actually, she and her husband, they're not in your class anymore.
They're not. So maybe I should, is this where I leave? they're not, but we've sent them out to teach another class. So your brother-in-law is now a teacher.
Good example, another class. They planted another class, another group. Right. Wow. Okay. But he's here. His group does somewhat of a mixture between the community home groups and Capitol Hill Baptist's more almost seminary course style. And I'm just kind of a traditional Sunday school guy. So so you see these different perspectives on the panel. I want to start off by asking you, Mark, what is the purpose of the Sunday school hour that your church has? What's the purpose of that smaller group meeting?
Well, let me begin by saying what it's not.
Okay.
It is not the main way of delivering Christian education. That happens through the sermon. It is not the main way of discipling. That happens by one-on-one discipling in the church. We call it a culture of discipling, which is what we want to see going on. We're trying to do something fairly narrow with that time because we have community groups also. 70% of our members probably are in them during the week. But what we have on Sunday morning would be a much lower percentage of the congregation participating, probably about 25% maybe participating. And we have topic-specific classes. We have several different years' worth of tracks of classes. Goes Old Testament and New Testament introduction, basic Christian stuff, including evangelism, stuff about friendship, courtship, dating, marriage, all the way to evangelism, apologetics, missions, worldview, work. So those are classes where we're trying to supplement the educational life of the church.
So would you say that the primary purpose of those meetings are educational? Even though that's not the primary place for education in the church, but the primary purpose of those meetings would be...
Yeah, trying to have regularly available, very specific teaching that's more specific than we're going to be doing every Sunday morning. And if we've gone through all 4 years' worth, then I took each of my kids through them, their 4 years of high school. I would sit through the classes with them. When you get through them all, we say grab somebody else who's new to the church and take them through them. So it becomes a platform for discipling.
Okay. Michael?
Our Sunday school classes, I mean, they're also educational, but we want to make sure that we have clearly defined purposes in our church, too. So, for example, the community groups that we have, that's where we see the majority of the pastoral care that takes place, rather than through the Sunday school class environment. So when somebody has a baby, when somebody is sick, a lot of the pastoral care happens through the community groups as opposed to the Sunday school. Also, you know, we spend the majority of the time in the community groups in not necessarily teaching, but more facilitating discussion and praying. But we would see the that was really fuzzy.
It's a long day, man.
Yeah, I believe that. So we spend the majority of the time in Sunday school doing actual teaching. Whereas in the smaller groups, it would be more facilitating what's happened in the sermons, trying to take the sermon to a deeper level and that kind of thing.
But in the times around the Sunday school, you would be similar to Capitol Hill, and that education is one of the primary purpose of that time.
Yeah, okay. Definitely.
Okay, Matt.
Okay, we're a bit of a hybrid. Primarily, we want to get our members into groups, and then those groups. Are driven by materials based off of the sermon. Sometimes that's in-house material that we've written. Sometimes that's out-of-house stuff that we've identified and have taken and kind of made our own. And that doesn't mean like stealing it. It's just like we purchase a license and then tweak what we want to tweak on it and roll it out that way. And
it's nice that you guys don't steal.
No, that's well, I just wanted to throw that out there. We're not just taking somebody's stuff, putting our logo on it, but apparently that stuff happens. But that's the primary way. And then twice a year for 8 weeks, we have classes at our campuses that are everything from, that they can be theological, they can be, I think some of the ones going on right now is we've got a parenting class going on right now. We have a ton of babies and first-time parents, and so it's an eight-week class on what does it look like, biblically. What is God's commands on the husband? What's God's commands on the wife? There's a class down on the Dallas campus that's primarily 20-somethings on dating, courtship, those things. There have been classes on. I could just go on and on, but that's kind of the feel. So twice a year, you have eight-week courses, three at each campus. And then predominantly, though, we want everybody in home groups.
Okay. Now, when these different groups meet, especially the ones that are focused on education, let's start there. There's a lot of talk about different learning styles. So at Capitol Hill, it's going to be more lecture-based. There's also the model of more of a facilitation-based, where the leader is trying to facilitate discussion about the Bible passage being studied. And then there's sort of a hybrid. It's closer to lecture-based, but the master-teacher approach, where there is discussion, but it's more, it leans more toward a leader presenting materials. Strengths and weaknesses of these different approaches, what would you... obviously, you're going to go more toward the lecture-based in the Sunday school hour that you all have. Why do you see that as more effective than the more facilitation-based, which is popular, too?
Oh, we do use the facilitation-based in one kind of 9 marks track we do. But other than that, it is just a sort of information dump. We are trying to get people, sometimes you don't come from any kind of Christian background at all, to get the basic parts of a Christian worldview. So we're trying to communicate the Old and New Testament. We're trying to communicate systematic theology and church history. We're trying to communicate the global commands of Christ. So all of those things mean some just specific teaching, and we find it's a better stewardship of time just to lecture it.
Okay. What do you see as the strengths and weaknesses of the lecture base versus the other side? Master teacher, right?
Yeah, it's more of a master teacher. I mean, part of it, I think, is the expectations that you have for your leaders, and also the leaders that God has given you. So if, you know, the Lord has brought into your fellowship, you know, people where you've got 40 people at the drop of a hat who have a seminary level education and are more than capable of preaching on Sunday morning or teaching a Sunday school class, that's going to dictate some of the expectations that you have for your leaders. If you don't have those kind of resources, then that's going to dictate the expectations that you have too. We have a little bit of both in our church, and so we can be able to say to a community group leader, the expectation here is not for you to be a teacher. You know, our pastor is going to teach on Sunday morning. The expectation for you here is to guide a discussion based on the content that he's already delivered. And that frees people up to be able to lead, whereas they might previously be incredibly intimidated. But because in Sunday school, our Sunday school classes, it's a bit more informational based than strictly discussion based, then we place a higher expectation on that, to where there's we require a higher level of study. And people in our church culture have grown to expect that from Sunday school. So now at this point, they walk in there and they expect to be to have a lot of information come at them, maybe more so than they would have in a community group environment. But I think the leadership that the Lord puts in your church, and knowing that and understanding that, that's going to drive some of the model too. As far as the strengths and weaknesses go, I mean, the strength of the lecture base is that it is very efficient for communicating essential information. The corresponding weakness to something that's facilitating is that, man, that thing, if anybody's ever been in a group like that, those things can go off the tracks really, really fast, you know? I mean, and just everything tips over, and pretty soon you're talking about space aliens or something like that, you know? So it that's one of the weaknesses of that group. But I think that the strengths and weaknesses can be overcome through the training of the leadership, that you can train leaders in ways to be able to deal with the space alien issue when it comes up.
Matt, would you say for your groups that are home are going to be discussion based? Would you say
they do? So I'm preaching through Galatians right now, and so they'll have homework during the week, and they'll have everything from a sermon to listen to or read on top of what I've preached. So it's not necessarily aligned with what I'm preaching as much as it's out of the same text that I just came out of. And so it's getting hit from multiple angles. So,
but you guys decide what that material is that they're looking
absolutely.
At?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No one in our home groups is allowed to use curriculum that has not been approved by the village. And say in a season like this one, we've dictated all our home groups in this season are going through this guide. So once a year, we do that. Once a year, we say this time, all groups everywhere, you're going through this material. And
I'm glad to hear you talk to say that your groups are not simply, sometimes the way the sticky church model works out in practice, and one of the concerns I have with it is when you've got a well-known pastor or, you know, a good preacher, and you'll get basically an outline of the message with a couple of scripture passages thrown in and some discussion questions, and that becomes the bulk of the education that's taking place in the smaller group setting. And what can happen is you're one step removed, you're farther removed from the text. So you're in some cases, you will actually have churches, they're no longer digging into the Bible for themselves as a group, they're actually discussing the pastor's sermon. So they're becoming experts in their pastor's view of Hebrews or whatever he's preaching through, and they're not actually digging into some of those texts. I'm glad to hear that's how the village
is.
Yeah,
we want to, at this period of time, really from February to the end of June, we want everyone at the village, regardless of age, to be thinking, praying, working, reading the book of Galatians. And so every angle, everywhere you go, the topic's going to be a passage in Galatians. And so come June, if they've put in any effort at all to be connected to the body, which is, you know, covenantally they're bound to,
right,
then they're going to know Galatians what the theme is, what the message is, that honestly, just keeps banging that drum. We're just about out of three, out of chapter three now, and I'm wondering if they're not starting to go, we get it, all right, not the law, we understand. So that's our hope, because the guide that we're going through, we didn't do this one. So this is literally another church produced this one. We asked them if we could use it. We needed to tweak a little bit of it theologically. We made it look more like us, and then rolled it out. And so it's been spectacular. So that's kind of how we're wired.
A question on facilitation-based groups or discussion-based groups. Back when the small group explosion took place, I guess, I don't know how long ago it's been, 70s, 80s.
Acts 2.
How's that?
That was at Acts 2 when that exploded. I'm sorry, Trevin, I'm sorry.
Matt, you're throwing me off. There was a lot of churches moved away from sort of the traditional Sunday school model that was clustered around the worship service, or even if they kept those times, they moved into a more discussion-based thing, and a lot of people found that refreshing because they had never really had the ability to discuss the text together and apply it well. What I see sometimes, and when I talk to people who have been through sort of the small group methodology for years and years, is I'll talk to people, though, today, and they'll say they've never had a satisfying Bible study experience in a small group. And I'll say, well, why is this? And you start to analyze what's happening, and you realize, well, because the educational component has moved to the side. At first, you had a lot of people who were well-educated in the scriptures and theologically coming together to discuss things, really good discussion. But as the educational component was left aside for the discussion-based, you eventually had more of the discussions get more and more shallow because the people have not been digging deeper and deeper until eventually the discussions are no longer where that is. Is that fair? I know there's exceptions, I'm sure, but would...
Yeah, I think so. Maybe another way to phrase it would be that... one of the disadvantages of, I think, just a small group model that you have to be aware of, and I would think guard against, is constantly asking the question of what does the text mean to you, to the point where you never really ask what does the text mean first. So it's one of the things I think you have to safeguard, to make sure that you have the sound exegesis and that we understand what the text means for all of us, regardless of who you are, before you start saying what the text means.
But that requires teaching. That requires actual teaching, not just I'm leading a discussion. I mean, someone in the room needs to know the scriptures well enough to expound
but
that.
There's two ways to do that. So I would absolutely agree. But the other thing is, if you've got a leader's guide that's really walking that leader into the text, not just here's the illustration, you're going to need a bag of marbles and but you're digging them into the text, and then your people have done homework leading up to the group walking. They're walking in with a knowledge of the text and not walking into, like I said, icebreaker. And so I think that's a bit different. So I think it's what you present to your leaders, and like Michael said, how you've trained your leaders to think about group. And so I've said, and we literally had to write a position paper on it, because I said, I've said from the stage, I don't care what you think about the text. I care what the text says. So the worst thing that can happen is everybody sitting around talking about what they think about the text. The text says something, that's what we need to get to. And so if you build that culture, then ultimately people aren't coming to group going, well, I think, my aunt has a farm in the Northwest, and she said, it becomes about the text, because that's where they've been all week. They've done their homework, they've read, they've listened to another sermon, they're memorizing a portion of it. It becomes a part, that's what they want to come talk about. So I think it's what you give them to do during the week. If you ask them to do nothing and then show up and there's just some questions based on the sermon, like, what'd you like about his sermon? Well, man, that story he told about being dressed as Batman, that was crazy. That's where people tend to go. Versus if you really give them meat to eat, then that's what they want to talk about. I mean, I saw this, and this, I never even thought of this. And that's where conversation goes, if before they get there, they're in the text. And so that's how we want to push our people.
I think you can actually take that maybe one step further back. One of the reasons why I think that works for you guys, and Mario, I've learned a lot from listening to you talk about this issue is that not just in the groups, but starting from the very foundation, the kind of culture that you create at the village. So you're from the beginning, from the stage, from the pulpit, you're creating the kind of culture where people understand the primacy and the importance of the Word of God. Yeah. So that you're not trying to take like a hard right turn when you get into small groups to where people all of a sudden think, oh, so we're serious about the Bible in this environment, but it's Batman in this environment, you know? So it's all of these things are latched together from the foundation of the culture of the church that you create.
I want to push back. We've hit on some of the dangers of the discussion based. I think that can be an effective way of learning, actually. So I'm not denying that can be a great way, especially if the level of people, if they're studying the scriptures, if they're actually doing homework, like you said, it's difficult to get people to do that sometimes, but you're wanting to have that sort of culture of the word being central to the church's life and to individuals' lives. But let's push again, let's push on the other end just a bit, because T4G, we're kind of known as the information dump kind of people. So certainly there are dangers on the side of, I'm going to present a lot of content, lecture for an hour, and everyone go home with a seminary class type education after they've been through a series. There's got to be dangers on this side as well. So what are some of the pitfalls of just, I'm just going to present this information?
Well, in our format, we only have about 35 minutes really to do it in a class, which is not that long. Because we do it week to week, there's no consistency of attendance. I mean, you know, somebody may be out of town for two weekends out of seven. We try to militate against variableness in teacher by having a manuscript. So we have a manuscript that's always being revised for each class. They're all available for free, downloadable on our website, catbap.org. You can go find all this stuff. But, you know, teachers can take that good manuscript, good material, and be deadly boring with it. And so, you know, I don't know how many course seminar classes I've been in that have just been really, really boring. And it kills me sometimes to watch this great material done really poorly. So, like Michael was saying, you know, when you do the more lecture thing, if it works well, it is great. Yeah. When it does not work well, which is pretty easy to happen, then you're yawning, you know, and people are getting disinterested in at least that aspect of Christian education. So it's a bit of a gamble.
As someone who works on curriculum, I feel the same thing when I think of it being in the hands of a teacher who's going to make it boring, you know, because it certainly wasn't boring in the creating of the curriculum. But your church is closer to Capitol Hill than my church would be. What are some of the things you've seen in that, sort of the information focus of the educational process?
Yeah, I would agree with that too. That it's, I mean, it can be dry as dust. Is a danger. Another danger, particularly if that's all you do, is that there can be a distinct lack of connection among people in the class, because even if you don't communicate this, what you're implicitly saying through the type of class and the logistics of the class, what you're implicitly saying is, look, you're not really here to meet people. You're here to get this information. And so it can have sort of an isolating effect, which I suspect led to kind of the emergence of like total small groups, and people were so energized by it, because for the first time it was finally I'm really, really meeting people and connecting with them at a deeper level than I ever really have before. And so I think that's one thing that you need to look out for, particularly if that's all you have, to make sure that you are providing specific ways for people to connect with each other at a deeper level. And I think there's all kinds of ways that you can build that into your church culture and the expectations that you have for people.
Yeah, I think using this kind of lecture style means you explicitly say that's not what we're trying to do in that time.
That would obviously be
a bad tool to use if that were the goal.
Well, some of the hang-ups for us that forced our model was one, space. The lecture model requires much more space. And then the second thing was we're already doing that. And so I'm preaching for 50 minutes the hour before, the hour after. So you go, okay, we need twice the parking. We need multiple multi-purpose rooms. And that means we're going to have a lot of children in childcare for the hours. And so those, it really, for us, our movement was much more of a contextualized, which I know we'll talk about tonight, but this is what we can do with what we have. And so it forced us to create based off some of the restrictions that we had. So I think two of the kind of weaknesses of the lecture style are it's going to require more space. And then number two, you're already doing that on Sunday morning. So now I don't think everything has to be in alignment, but now they're not just thinking what Mark just preached on. They're thinking what Mark just preached on and their Sunday school class. And so however you want to divide what that is, teaching, preaching, whatever, but they just heard two different things, and now they're leaving going two different things. Whereas I know what my heart is. I want to get in on something.
But is that necessarily bad?
Because I don't think it's necessarily bad. I think it can be bad.
Well, I mean, my thing is, let's say you're preaching through Hebrews for 3 years. Like some pastors, I mean, they're expositional. They're going to go through, and the small groups are aligned with whatever the pastor's doing. Well, if especially in the transitory society that we live in, the transitional nature, people moving in and out. I mean, someone could come into your congregation, could trust Christ, could get plugged into a group. You know, they're discussing Hebrews for a long time, but they haven't had the educational component to really see the rest of the Bible as well as they might have if they had been in a group that was also studying different parts of Scripture. And I wonder if what we sacrifice when we move so quickly toward alignment, if we're not somehow keeping our people from the whole riches of God's Word, understanding and studying in a small group or a Sunday school hour, because we're focused on keeping everyone on one message when people think about lots of messages all throughout the week. So I'm just... You know, I work through that. I kind of wonder, the alignment is great, but at what cost?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, one thing about that, and we're just to defend doing things that way, which we don't do that way, but I think sometimes people misunderstand, particularly like the long expositional series. I don't do that. I don't generally like a three-year kind of series idea. I do 4 months usually at most. Every once in a while, a major New Testament book I'll do a year. But then we'll have a lot of other people preaching during it that won't be in that series. But what you're doing, like when Matt puts on Galatians, he's not staring at Galatians. He's staring at all of life as he applies it with the spectacles of Galatians especially on. Okay. So when you're preaching in Hebrews, you're not like in a seminary class just dissecting a chiastic structure in the argument. I mean, you're looking at all of the things in life that are addressed in that. And when you're a preacher, you're applying it to the things going on in life with the special concerns that you see through the book of Hebrews. So I don't think it's quite as limiting as it can sound.
That's good.
And I don't do it, but I don't think it's quite as limiting.
There are some contexts, though, that's where how people preach. And
I'm
then
sure
it
that's
can
true.
Well, and honestly, as I've walked with the members of the village, my concern for them is not that they don't know enough. My concern is that they simply don't apply what they know. And so they're hungry for new information without having applied the information they know that's so basic and simple that I don't want to keep flooding them with information they're not doing anything with. I'd rather slow it down and confront them with information that they need to do something with and really drill down on it. So, the reality is we'll find out. I mean, that's where we're praying a lot, working hard, and you know, 10 years from now, you know, I think CJ said to me earlier, or somebody said to me earlier, that Matt Chandler a year from now is going to want to talk to Matt Chandler right now, and that's so true. And so I think what we're doing is smart and good, and the Spirit's going to bless and work. But I mean, there's no doubt that 10 years from now we will have swung, it, you know, more than likely probably farther than we should, and then our kids will come back and overcorrect, but maybe not.
Just to speak in favor of the lecture thing, one more thing that's really helpful about it, Matt. Even though, let's say I'm preaching through James right now, you know, we have tons of people in their 20s and 30s who, some of whom are converted pretty recently, and there's a really godless dating culture. That makes us look no different than the world. Well, I can't apply scripture on that every time I preach. You know, I'm preaching to all these people, not just to this group, though it's a large group. But what we found is that if we put some specific teaching on, you know, marriage and courtship, dating, friendship, if we do that every year over 13 weeks, we've dripped that into the congregation, and, you know, just 20, 30, 40, 50 people come each time. But you do that 5, 6, 7, 8 years in a row, it begins to affect the culture of the church. Yeah. So they've got that thing going on first. Then they have the sermon. There's no doubt when they leave, the sermon is what's ringing in their minds and hearts. But we have done some informing and some provoking of a subset of the congregation,
which is why we add those classes. Yeah. So we do have the lecture format for that type of scenario and situation where we're just simply not going to hit, specifically like a parenting, like a courtship, dating, friendship, those kind of, those are the ones we want to put in those lecture formats. And I would agree they do leave because they're still in their group. They're still thinking Galatians. They're still, but it is part of, like you said, part of trying to create air that they breathe so that then when they give each other advice, it's, well, you know, I'll tell you what, if he's not doing that, I'd drop that bump.
How do you all determine what information needs to be presented to people? You know, sometimes the temptation is a young pastor goes to seminary, learns amazing stuff about the Bible and all sorts of different areas and wants to come into the congregation and wants to teach this to everybody. And so, you're starting off your series on John with five reasons why we believe that the John who wrote this is the beloved disciple. You know, when pretty much everybody in the group, it probably already is there, but or here's the reason why you should believe that Paul wrote the Pauline epistles, or here's the historical background for another, and can be interesting, and even in the hands of a gifted teacher can be actually engaging to some people there, but that person who's teaching that is obviously going to think, this is really important for everyone in here to understand, when it might actually be one or two people who might wrestle with that, who might have asked the teacher later a question like that. So how do you determine what is truly important for people to know and act upon versus what somebody somewhere has said is really important and this needs to be discussed and needs to be out there?
I know how we do that. We do it through a combination of things that are static and things that are dynamic. So, for example, we want to have as an offering for people all the time something that we know that they need all the time, regardless of what's happening. So we're always going to have like one Sunday school class that is walking through systematically Scripture, Old Testament, New Testament, that ends up serving just sort of like an ongoing survey course for Old Testament and New Testament. So we know that that's the case, and that's not going to change. People need that regardless of what circumstance there is. Then we try to counterbalance what's happening from the pulpit. So like, for example, if our pastor is preaching through Luke right now, so we might have something to counterbalance either a book from the Old Testament or maybe some other book in Scripture that brings out some emphasis that you don't necessarily find as much of in Luke, to try and balance that with a Sunday school class. And then we actually had two classes that we sort of let be driven by the culture of the church. So, like, for example, for us, I mean, for some reason, we've got a very fertile church. I mean, there's a new baby, you know, all the time. We have three kids, and we feel like with the third kid, we just became real parents in our church, you know? So we are likely
to
have...
Do the Duggars go to your church?
They do not, but they would, I mean, they would fit. We got some 15-passenger vans in the parking lot. So we know that a need for us, so these would be more need kind of driven classes that would be like parenting, marriage, that kind of thing. And then we rotate in those two more dynamic kind of arenas. We rotate those things in and out according to kind of what's happening in the congregation at the moment.
Mark, how do you decide what courses need to be available to your people and what you present in those courses as being available and for people?
Anybody here from Mount Vernon Baptist Church in Atlanta? Aaron Menikoff, I've seen around here. Aaron was the pastor there now, was on staff at our church. And he and I literally just sat down one day and tried to work out what's a basic curriculum. And there's nothing very advanced about it. I mean, it's, you know, Old Testament, New Testament, systematic theology, church history, and then basic things about the Christian life, evangelism, discipling, missions, apologetics. And we've stuck with it. Now, we've added things over the years as we've seen needs. You know, Ed Welch's book, When People Are Big and God Is Small, we decided it would be a great thing to teach. So Ken Barbick, one of the laymen in our church, just came up with a curriculum based on that, and he teaches the Fear of Man class. So it's grown over the years, but there's a core that just, I don't know, I would just say it's classical Christian catechesis, you know, basic things about the Bible and life and history and theology that not at all aimed at a kind of reproducing a seminary, but aimed very much at the guy who goes to work and, you know, the parents who are at home caring for the kids, aimed at just everyday people. What should you care about out of this period of the church's history or out of this doctrine of the church?
Mark, this is a question I actually have for you. Do you feel like that the curriculum is driven by the context that you're in. So what I mean is that, so in the city that I live in, I think we can expect to have people for longer than you. I mean, you've said before, I forget what the turnover rate is in D.C., but basically you got them for 2 years,
well,
maybe less.
It's not all of D.C. If we were an African-American church dominantly in Southeast, we'd have a very stable population.
Yeah, yeah.
Or if we were a mega church out in the suburbs, we could have people who live there for decades. But it just happens that we are historically a white church. Obviously, we're multi-ethnic now, but historically a white church. And all the those big old churches in the middle of the cities all died in the second half of the 20th century. By God's grace, we were resurrected. But we were resurrected with people who are 23 working for their senator or congressman after college, who then come and they fill up our pews for 3 years. And then they get married and it's too expensive. They can't live there anymore and they're gone.
So that's got to be a consideration you think, man, we've got 3 years. That's our window.
Well, yeah, we figure we got 2 to 4 years with most of the people sitting in front of us.
Where we might look at it a little bit differently in planning our curriculum because that window is going to be longer for us. Probably similar to you guys, too?
Yeah, we'll get some movement because of American Airlines, you know, so we'll have guys that are, you know, coming in either from Chicago for a few years and then back up. But for the most part, we're pretty stable. For whatever reason, Dallas and I think Texas in particular really has been shielded. I mean, almost recession-proof, it appears. Our housing market kind of always stays where it is. So there's not a ton of turnover. And it's not expensive to live in Dallas. And so we definitely have a longer time. We'll have a lot of lifers.
Well, I think that's a really important distinction. But when people are in there, because I mean, in a crowd this size, I'm sure there are people who come from an urban environment or a rural environment. And so if you're, you know, it might be worth the time of a pastor to actually sit down and put pen to paper and figure out what do we feel like is the median number of years that we have for people in this church. And if it turns out that you're in a rural area where you can expect that people are really going to be there for 10 plus years, that you don't feel the kind of immediate pressure that we have got to jam this down because we've only got 2.5 years and then they're leaving, you know?
We don't jam it down there. Oh,
well, you're a jammer.
All right. We do jam it down there.
But then, if you are in an environment where you just know, maybe it's a high graduate school environment or something like that, where people are there and they're in and then they're out, then I think it's good and right that you. I mean, you need to feel that we've only got this long with these guys. We've got this long, and we've got to.
And a lot of them, in our case, are newish Christians.
So we're trying to
equip them then to go to your church, and get integrated there.
A question that comes up a lot is about age-graded classes and groups. Or groups that are kind of based around life stage. I know at Capitol Hill it's based on the class. So it's is that on the topic of the class?
If they're a child, no. We do age graded for learning developmentally. By the time you're an adult, right.
Right. So but someone will choose and go to a different class. It's not the same class. It's different than what my church does, for example, where we're one group going through a set curriculum. You have a set curriculum, and people will rotate through and through. Your church age, is it age or life stage, or how do your groups come together? The geographical?
The groups are geographical.
Okay.
And then there's age-based stuff through fifth grade or sixth grade, and then starting seventh grade on, they go group, off-campus group. So,
but that the age-graded kids you're talking about is not taking place at the same time as the adults are meeting in their groups at homes. That's happening during the worship service?
No, yes.
Okay.
So they'll go and they'll do... my oldest, Audrey, is 9, and she goes Saturday night, 7:15. They come together. There's a lesson taught. And then they break into small groups and they further discuss that message. And then when we pick her up, we get a little homework sheet for her for that week. And so we're already trying to teach them, this is what rhythm looks like at the Village Church.
Right.
This is what it means to be a part
this is
of
what everyone does
the church.
At the church.
Yeah. And so when we talk with Audrey, we talk about her group. And then she comes, the kids come to the group I'm in. Once a month, we bring all the kids, and they run around, and we do a meal together, and then they get to see what we do. Now, that's a much more chaotic group than, say, it would be on a normal Wednesday night. But
so you're geographical. Yours is course-based.
Well, we also have geographical groups. It's just
right,
not the Sunday morning ones.
Yeah. Right. That's where you do the purpose of community. And what about yours? Not age graded?
No, ours is not age graded. Again, once you get out of high school, so you graduate from high school and get into college, it is a it is a pick your class kind of deal.
The church I'm at now, I would say, is semi-age graded. Age graded meaning, in the church that I served in most recently as well, there were ages on there for visitors, so that visitors knew where to go. But the classes wound up being multi-generational. Most of the classes wound up being multi-generational, and so I'm wondering, is the age graded? Can it be a danger if we're dividing the generations to where older people are not serving younger people not learning from older people, we're not sharing together? But could it be helpful if it's sort of an on-ramp for someone who's brand new, who doesn't know where quite to fit in? They wind up going to a class that's got an age on it, and it might kind of tend toward that age, but not necessarily be, hey, you're 55 now, you have to go to this class, you know, that kind of a thing. Any thoughts, dangers with that?
I mean, the attractional stuff is always good for evangelism, but the more you get that into the very core of the church, I don't think that's as wise. I think what you're doing in the church is exactly drawing against those sort of natural lines. So there's nothing wrong with, you know, four guys who are in their 50s having a conference together. That's absolutely fine. But what we want to see in the local church is an expression of the fullness of the body of Christ, which exactly means having relationships that are going to be surprising to the world as they look on. So if you're thinking about the visitor, I'd just be very careful about planning my church based on the visitor.
Yeah, I was just thinking not necessarily that the whole church is based around that, but that you at least have some way for a visitor to come in and know and be able to be ushered somewhere.
But when visitors come in to us, I mean, first of all, we have an assembly where everybody meets together. So if they're in time, they hear all the teachers introduce their classes and they go to the one that sounds interesting.
Right.
But even if they come in later and I'm in the hall and have to meet one, I'll just tell them what the classes are and then invite them to.
So they go based on their groups.
I think it's worth asking the question, building on what you said, Mark, is because you are sacrificing something, right? So it's going to be, if somebody comes and they walk into a Sunday school class and they look around and they don't see people that look exactly like them, there can be that sense of awkwardness. But if you're sacrificing something, I mean, look at what you're gaining. So, I'll give you a practical example that happened in our class this week, which was phenomenal. There's two guys in my Sunday school class right now, both of whom are named Andy. And one is named Andy, and he is 25 years old, single young man, very, very bright, doing some contract work here and there, but great guy. The other Andy in my class is a retired doctor who is probably 65-ish or so, regularly makes trips overseas to work with women in war-torn countries. Great guys. And these two guys, these two Andys, have started sitting next to each other in Sunday school. The awesome thing was that young Andy came on Sunday, said, "Hey man, how's it going?" "Oh, it's great. I've had a tremendous weekend." And I said, "Really? Tell me about it." And he said, "Old Andy took me to the roller derby on Friday." So in downtown Nashville, old Andy and young Andy went to the roller derby together in downtown Nashville. So this is back to the point. So yeah, when young Andy came into the Sunday school class, it was a bit awkward for him because he didn't know exactly who to sit by, but he found a place with this guy, and now they went to the roller derby together, and they are genuine friends. They're genuinely friends. So you sacrifice the awkwardness, but then you look at what you've gained, which is people on the outside look in and they think to themselves, where on earth except the church can this kind of thing happen?
That's great.
There's nowhere else that this happens. I mean, it doesn't happen at Rotary Club. It doesn't happen at the Lions Club. This is where generations and racial barriers and all kinds of things, it's only in this place where that kind of bridge is made.
Social barriers too.
Yeah,
Where else do you go where a guy who is a plumber throughout the week might not have even gone to college can be teaching from a place of spiritual leadership people in the congregation who are new believers who have PhDs.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a beautiful thing that you're not going to see anywhere else. But
so from the visitor's perspective, then you've got to wonder what is more powerful and helpful for them? Is it to feel immediately comfortable in a class where you walk in and look like everybody, or to walk in and have your mind blown by all of these people from different social classes and races and socioeconomic backgrounds and all this kind of stuff, actually learning together and praying for each other? So, I mean, that's one of the reasons that I love the fact that we have all that mixing that happens.
Yeah, I had a class that started out once as age graded, and it began to evolve multi-generational just because of what we were teaching. And so I talked to the pastor about it, and he's like, this is not a problem. Embrace that. Let that happen. Enjoy that, because you've got older people. You got college students sitting next to people in their 70s and loving each other there in the small group study, studying the same thing. Now, talking about community, this is a question that comes up that I know Matt's going to see a high value, and I would agree on groups studying the scriptures together over time as they grow closer to God. So, and that's going to be different than what we're seeing, what we see at Capitol Hill, where you have the course people going with different people in the congregation. The group really, it's really the hour of teaching, not the group itself. And the only way I know how to compare this as far as from an educational philosophy is at Southern Seminary, I did classes on campus, did J-term classes, internet classes, and Extension Center classes in Nashville, so and independent study. So just about every type of way you could get an education from Southern, I wound up trying all of them. And I tell you what was intriguing to me, as great as it was being on campus and just going, you know, basically taking my classes and building them around my work schedule. The Extension Center classes in Nashville, once I was in ministry, tended to be the same guys every semester going through whatever classes were being offered. And some of the friendships made and the, hey, we're learning this together. We're talking, this time it's church history together, and we're talking about this at lunch. And then talking about, you know, ministry battles and things going on in the congregation. It was, I feel like the education was different when I was with the same group of people than when it was all course-based. So I wonder, what role does the community, does the actual group play in the educational process? Any one of you want to
speak? Well, I think it'd be significant, which is why we have community groups that are, you know, not based on the course, but it's the same people who are together for years studying things. Yeah, I think it's a very important other aspect of learning.
So you take that and you apply that in the community group setting, the small group setting.
Where we have three times more people involved than we do in the lecture,
Sunday morning things. Okay.
So I'll tell you where we've had to battle on that front then, is it doesn't take long for that all of a sudden to no longer be about helping a weaker brother. It all of a sudden becomes, you know, we've done that. And so that's a drum we're learning. We have to start to beat with them that ultimately you are responsible for your brother. You do have to, the stronger has to take care of the weaker. And gospel-centered community is a community where the strongers don't despise the weaker, but remember that at one point they were weaker and someone stronger gave them time, gave them a door in, gave them a seat at the table, which is why they're now strong. And so what we've learned as the community deepens, they also have a tendency to silo. And so you have to, and this goes back to kind of that missional, intentional, we're always going to have new believers here. And I mean, that's healthy to have new believers here. And so if we've got new believers here, that means we have immature newborns which are going to require attention. And some of them aren't going to have real high relational capacity, and some of them are coming out of places where they're just difficult people. And so I think the error on community is the idea that Christian community is that we all like each other.
And then it can become ingrown very quickly.
Very quickly.
In these sort of settings. So we're always on guard against that. Do you have anything to say about how to keep a group ingrown, Michael?
I would say the missional intentionality.
How to keep them ingrown? That's easy.
Keep
just leave them alone.
Yeah, yeah. Ingrown.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's a natural tendency. I think that. I mean, I think the missional tendency, that you build that into the expectation, the fabric of your group. So I think you can do that in all different sorts of ways. You know, so maybe it's that for your groups, the expectation becomes you spend 3 weeks in somebody's home, and then the fourth week you're always out doing something, you know, just to make sure that that's part of the regular group of life. I think another thing that you can practically do to help with that is that you put into the DNA of your groups a reproducing kind of mindset, to where it's an expectation on the community group leader that, yeah, we expect for you to facilitate this discussion, we expect for you to help shepherd these people, and by the way, we also expect by the end of the year that you will have let us known who the Lord has brought into this group, who's going to lead another group, and then you purposefully divide your group at the end of that year and send some people over here with this guy and some people are going to stay here with me and that kind of thing. But it's, you know, a lot of that has to do, I think, with the expectations that you set.
Well, and I think you've got to build out language that everybody understands, this is what we're doing. And so without that language, all they're left with is, you know, if they have maturity but not multiplication, then I mean, all their energy, all their thinking, all there is maturity, which is great. I want them to mature, but you don't mature if you're not multiplying. And so I think you've got to put language around it where people can know maturity is multiplication. And so they're thinking along the lines that it's not I'm mature once I know all these things, right, but rather I'm mature when I'm multiplying what I know.
A disciple is reproducing.
There we go.
The mark of maturity, rather than a disciple has been through all of the Bible and knows all these facts.
Sure.
A question that comes up often, someone was asking us earlier about childcare, about doing, now this is an adult education panel, but sometimes especially when space is an issue, you'll see sometimes churches, they've got the adults meeting, doing a Bible study over here. They'll have kids from different ages that are kind of shafted off into another room. There might be someone who's trying to do a Bible study, but it's not necessarily, it's hard to do something that's age appropriate when you've got a variety of ages. For people especially that have space issues, I know in all three of our contexts, we've got space to be able to do age-graded Sunday school for kids, where they're learning at age-appropriate levels. But how do you do that with when you've got space issues, Matt?
Well, we have, for our children, we have one multi-purpose space on each of the campuses that's large enough for a singular gathering for them where they receive teaching, and then they do have little rooms in each of the retrofits of the building. So we had two buildings given to us, both needed a lot of work, and so when we redid those buildings, we put small rooms that could hold 6 to 10 children, and then they break into those groups after the teaching and singing and go through a bit of a group study like we would as adults. And then, like I said, when I pick up my daughter, when I pick up my son, I get a sheet that's getting them ready for next week.
Is keeping them in the worship service for the singing and the beginning parts and seeing at the church go a way of keeping them incorporated into the body? Because a lot of churches, it's just you drop off your kids. And remember, we were visiting a church when we first moved to the Nashville area. And, I mean, walked in, we were taking our kids to the drop-off place, and I said, do we need to come and get our kids after the Sunday school hour to go to church? No. You don't have to see them again the rest of the time. And he was like, and don't worry, they won't be bored a minute. I was like, well, I really wasn't concerned about them not being bored a minute. It was really disconcerting that I would not see my child again for the next 3 hours. But that was a plus for this congregation. Yeah. We didn't join there. But
we'll throw out, and we'll say often, I know in particularly different campuses will emphasize it even more, but man,
I want my kids.
Yeah,
in there.
Absolutely. As soon as your child can sit there and participate, we want them to come. In fact, we've even written stuff on how you can help them get there.
Yeah.
What should be some things? How can you incorporate them? How can you? And that's not here's something for him to color on while we do this. And so Jen Wilkin, I think one of her blogs ran on the Gospel Coalition, I think last week or so, but she's been brilliant at helping our young mothers and fathers understand, okay, how do you ease them into what for us is an hour and a half long service?
Yeah, because, I mean, there's got to be a danger with student ministry. I mean, there's some churches that have, you know, student worship, kids worship. I mean, you could go years without ever being in the same worship service. And there's, I mean, we lose something massive in that. Do you see that as a trend?
It certainly was a trend. I think now for the last 10 years, there's definitely been corrections of that. So, you know, like just here, I'm just here. How many of you have children in at least part of your main Sunday morning gathering? Okay, that's the overwhelming majority. So, and I think that's been the way it's been going for a while now.
We're winding this discussion down. Curious as to what you all would say to a pastor who maybe is new to the church, to the congregation, has space and has inherited a Sunday school structure of some sort. This kind of goes back to the Nine Marks e-journal that we discussed. The cool thing now, and partly because, you know, people like Mark Driscoll and other pastors will go around, you know, saying, you know, kill your Sunday school, all two people won't care anyway, you know, that kind of thing. The thing is, whatever you've got, there's a better way to do it. And here's that. I once had a guy come to me who, you know, we have about, at the church that I was serving in, we had about 85% of our congregation that was in church, in the service on a Sunday morning, was also involved in Bible study beforehand. Now, I don't think we judge success by how many people we have in a room, because it depends on what's going on in those rooms and what's happening, and are they ingrown? Are they reaching out? But at least the very thought of having that many people together, 85% was something I wanted to maintain. I thought that was good. I had a guy come and say, hey, I think we should ditch this and do all community groups. And so I called a church that was seeing some success with this model, and because I'm open to changing methods, and talked with them, and I said, how many people on a given Sunday, they're in your congregation, on a Sunday morning, are also enrolled in one of these groups? He said, about half. I said, well, out of the ones enrolled, how many are actually attending in a given week? He said, about half of that. So I went back to my friend. I was like, you know, this group is doing good with the people that they have involved in these groups, but so either I can do something to make sure that the 85% I've already got there, I can make that the best possible experience, Bible study, that I can, or I can blow it up and wind up with 30% maybe in a group. So what would you recommend pastors do that have inherited a structure that might not be their first choice? They do have space, and they're thinking about possibly changing or doing something else. How would you advise them? How would you think about, if you advise them to change, how to go about that change? If you would advise them not to change, what to do in those settings?
For me, it would depend hugely on who the guy is, what his gifting is. If he's an exceptional teacher and the people are going to be following him, I might say one thing. But if it's not those kind of exceptional gifts, I would say take whatever you've got, just like you're saying, make it as good as you can. And any change you bring about, try to do that slow and gradual.
Okay.
I totally agree. You know, I guess the only thing that I would add is to invest more of the time in not only thinking about the structure, but actually purposefully articulating to the leadership that is going to be in place, what specifically are we trying to accomplish with this class? So, if you're trying to accomplish with your Sunday school classes for this to be the moment of fellowship, of real genuine community, where we deeply pray and invest in each other, if that's what it is, then empower your leaders to know that that's what it is, and empower them to say, man, brother, you pray for 30 minutes during this time, you know? I mean, just do it. But if it's not, if you're trying to accomplish a more educational feel with that, then let them know those expectations as well. So that way everybody's moving in the same way. Everybody has clarity, which I think is, clarity is very, very important. And so that everybody, I think it will decrease the amount of frustration from both people that are going to classes or going to groups and from the leadership in the long run.
Yeah, I don't really have anything else to add. I think that a wholesale change is rarely a good idea. It's rarely a good idea. And I think what happens, unfortunately, for guys that are trying to revitalize places is they've got a crush on another church. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. They've got a crush on this church. And so since this church does it this way, you want to try to force that into where you are. And, man, I love it. That's immature and foolish. And so I know there are places where change needs to occur, but wholesale change is rarely a good idea. And if you're making changes before you really know people and before you really know history and before, but you're doing it because you got a crush because Driscoll said, cancel your Sunday school class. Well, then you're immature. You've got to be able to see through statements like that. And because Mark's saying that because of a specific place and a specific context and a specific, and he doesn't know you. He doesn't know your church. He doesn't know where you've been, where those people have been. And so you're going to come in and make war against faithful saints who are being fed by the word of God because you've got a crush on something. And so I couldn't be, thank you for the one guy that is with me on this.
That's the and one so, out of the two that are still in Sunday
school. That's right. That's true. That's true. So so I would just say that I think the whole idea of we've got to change it is, I just think we're beating that drum too much, man. I think we're all trying to be too innovative.
If we're going to change, though, within the current structure that we've inherited, just make it better, make the purpose clear, be clear about what, because, you know, there are lots of Sunday school classes where at some point there was a clear purpose, but now it's, we get together, we stand around, we eat coffee and donuts, we have prayer requests for 30 minutes, and we open up the Bible and talk for 15 minutes, pray, and then go to the service. I mean, you really can lose and dilute the purpose of whatever the group is meeting if it's not a constant.
No doubt.
It's not constantly communicated. Last question. How do we raise up leaders in using the different structures, whether it's community groups, whether it's Sunday school, more of the seminary style, the Sunday school hour? How do we raise up leaders to be able to lead these groups well?
For us, it's all about equipping. A leader that feels equipped, a leader that feels like they have resources at their disposal, it is much more confident in being able to lead out than someone that feels like they have to figure it out on their own. So if you were to go to our website right now and you were to click on our resource page, I mean, we have hundreds of two-page documents on just about any question you're going to get asked. And then we try to, we have round tables where our leaders, we kind of throw out topics and let them discuss things they're feeling in their group. So for us, it's all about equipping, creating feedback loops. They know they've got somebody's ear. They know they can get training when they hit a wall. They know that we're available. They know we're all hands on deck. In fact, some of our pastors have pressed on me before because at last year's group leader conference, I was like, we will not fail you. We won't. And then someone like, well, we might fail them. And I was like, no, we won't fail them. So whatever we have to figure out here, let's figure it out. But we need to get them what they need. So create feedback loops that tell us what they need. And what we found is that if a guy feels like you're in the trenches with him, that you didn't just go, okay, go, good luck. Here's 15 dysfunctional people, make it work, you know, but you're there with him, then they're much more apt to tell a guy they love, hey, man, you can do this. Yeah. If I can do this, you can do this. But the more you don't equip those guys and you're not near them and you haven't created feedback loops, they're not going to tell other guys you can do that. They're going to go, this thing's a whipping. Can we do this at your house next? I mean, so the more you can help them, the more people will flock and want to be a part of that.
Whether they might even say, not only you can do this, but hey, brother, we'll do this together. Yeah. You know, I'm going to do this with you. I know that has been helpful for me in terms of taking leadership positions in the past, is not just when another leader has said, we want you to lead, but has said, we want you to lead with us, you know? And so I, you know, even in teaching a Sunday school class, it was immensely helpful the first couple of times that I taught to be paired with one of the elders in our church, who is an older man than I am, and for that guy to very graciously and humbly over the course of the time that we taught together to encourage me, and then actually to see him sort of in subtle ways kind of stepping aside, and then now to have that expectation on me that's my job. That's what I need to do for another guy that is younger than me, is that I need to say, let's do this together, and then actively look for ways that I can encourage him and begin to step aside and pass on the mantle.
Yeah, we give them the kind of equipment in terms of information that we want them to teach, but then they have responsibility to edit and change. So those manuscripts are always being changed every semester that they're going on. Whoever the teacher is has the authority and the responsibility to change it. In a conversation with one of the pastors, there'll also be two or three people working on any given class. So if, let's say there are 13 classes, there'll be a lead teacher, but then there'll be a couple of backups. So there's always other people who are in the class who are listening regularly. So in the case, in a year, if we have, I don't know the numbers, if we have 25 different classes, we've got, you know, 80 to 100 folks who are teachers that are getting experience doing that every year. Well, that just develops teachers.
That's great. Well, thank you all for being part of this. I'll close us in prayer, and then we'll get on to the next session.